Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam is gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. In the studio today, by the way, I just want to say very quickly, thank you to everyone for making a really, really difficult weekend a lot easier. It was the Googa Booga and the Manhattan Cocktail Classic this weekend, and I think it went pretty well. That being said, I have one of my favorite cocktail and spirits writers in the studio today, Robert Simonson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I know that we were talking a little bit before the show about years past with the Manhattan Cocktail Classic and the Tales of the Cocktail and all these things. It's kind of it can get kind of overwhelming, and in such a good way, because before this we were just a bunch of enthusiasts hanging around reading old cocktail books, having cocktail parties, and now it's grown to a point where we can actually get together in different places in different cities and enjoy the camaraderie and the art and craft of classic cocktails and spirits.
Yeah, now we can go to like big hotels and big bars and gigantic conventions and talk about old cocktail books and old cocktails and things like that and do it together in one place.
Absolutely. And what the greatest part about that, to me at least, is that going from the cocktail parties at my house to going to a hotel or a venue is that I don't have to clean up afterwards.
Yeah, actually, the way I got introduced to this whole world, the cocktail world, was back in 2006 when I went to Tales of the Cocktail. That was the first year that I went. I met Ann Tunneman, who runs it, up here in New York. For some strange reason, she was helping open an Ely espresso pop-up cafe in Soho. I guess she had some fill-in work there. And she said, I run this little cocktail thing down in New Orleans. Maybe you want to go down. And at that point, I didn't know much about cocktails at all. And I said, yes. I went down there, and the moment I walked into the lobby of the Hotel Monteleone, I knew I'd gone down a rabbit hole of sorts, and I've never quite been back.
Absolutely. You know, it's really funny, too. Once you I guess it's like any other hobby or maybe habit in our world. So once you get into it, it's very difficult to get out of it. It's amazing to me. Before you were writing about cocktails and spirits, you were writing about theater.
Yes. I wrote for theater for about 15 years for various publications, for the New York Times and obscure theater publications that you've never heard of. And worked at Playbill and their website for a long time. And I enjoyed that. I got a little burnt out after a while. I ended up talking to the same people over and over again about the same subjects. Like the cocktail world, the theater world is a small universe, mm-hmm. only not necessarily populated by people who are enjoying themselves as much. So I felt it was time to move on to something else, and I'd always liked wine, and so I started educating myself. I took courses down at the International Wine Center, which is based in London, but they have a center here in New York. And so actually my entry into the liquor journalism world was first wine, and I wrote a wine column at the New York Sun for a while, and then I went down to Tales, and I had a revelation that spirits and cocktail people are very different from wine people. And yeah. I decided I liked the spirits and cocktail people more.
It's like jazz versus rock and roll. There are connections, but it's a little...
They are two definitely very separate worlds.
Yeah. So when you were writing about wine and when you were a wine enthusiast, as it were there any connections with like vermouth or sherry?
Not while I was doing. I was writing mainly about still wine and hanging out with wine writers. There was some talk of port and sherry, but not a lot. I mean, sherry had not been rediscovered as it has been in the past couple years.
Same with vermouth.
Same with vermouth, yes. And there was a real dividing line. The wine people didn't talk about cocktails. They didn't drink cocktails. Whereas I found in the cocktail world, there is enthusiasm for wine. Maybe not as much as it is for cocktails, but most of the bartenders, mixologists I like, they get enthusiastic about wine. They have their favorite wines. They like to drink it. But I didn't find that in the wine world. Another thing I found frustrating in the wine world is I found it very difficult to write about wine in an interesting way. Mm. I found that there was a very limited vocabulary, a certain number of words you can use, and it was hard to break out of that. I haven't had that problem with cocktail and spirits. Somehow, cocktails and spirits tell more of a story. There's more history. There's more drama.
Absolutely.
And you can really spin a yarn. You can captivate the reader's attention very quickly.
Absolutely. You know, like, I kind of found that problem. I think when I first met you, I was working at Linnell's down in Red Hook. And
that's right.
And what we would do... Linnell's was known a lot for its spirits and different like bitters and liqueurs and everything, and mostly bourbon and American whiskey. But we did a lot of wine sales. We had really obscure wines too.
Good wine selection.
Yeah, and like Amanda Womack from Cask, Ian Wolf, all people have been actually on the show. Old coworkers of mine there. We would find ourselves running out of verbiage and descriptors for wine. So we would start thinking outside of the box. We'd come up with a descriptor of the day, and it would always be really weird. And we'd kind of see if we could actually like nail it with this descriptor. So sometimes it'd be like, yeah, this, like an old, like, Barolo. It's like, it's haunted. It's like, you know, it's kind of, are you getting that? Are you picking, it's like, it has ghostly notes.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, stores like yours and like Smith & Vine, which is in the same neighborhood where you and I live in Carroll Gardens, they can do that with the descriptors. I found that wine publications, you know, kind of discourage that kind of thing. You know, right. It's just like, it's fruity, it's jammy, you know, high tannins, blah, blah, blah. You know, you pull the same words out of the same old hat.
Right.
And there was like this stiffness in the editorial leadership of the publications, and it got very frustrating.
And you know, like what you were saying before, to touch back on that, the history of a spirit or a cocktail with wine. I'm definitely not talking down on wine because I freaking love wine.
No, but I love wine too.
But yeah, the stories, like as far as like producers go and grape varietals go, like there's history behind it. But yeah, you're right. It's a much richer history and more.
Yeah, certainly there's a history behind every Bordeaux chateau, you know, and often it's a great history. But there's just something about cocktails because, as you and I know, often these histories are shrouded in myth. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's unknown. A lot of it is just bullshit. It's been told in bars, you know, decade after decade. And you have to get to the bottom of it. And at the end, you probably know that some of what you're telling still isn't the truth. But that's kind of cool. You know, it lends a romance to it. It lends a kind of a fog of romanticism.
I always find, as a bartender, too, things like chartreuse and things like absinthe that have, like, such insane histories, Benedictine, Fernet Branco, things like that. Even just like your like Angostura bitters, you know, all of those things I just name dropped, all those liqueurs and spirits that I just name dropped, those all are some of the most difficult spirits or ingredients to turn people onto. But once you're behind the bar or like on premise, wherever you are, you start talking about the history of it, people are immediately intrigued by it, and they want to try it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're like, oh, it's this weird bitter thing or this weird herbal thing, you know, that's been around for a long time and whatever.
Yeah, and often the formula is a secret.
Exactly.
And that always gets people. And nobody knows the secret. You know, two monks who live on a hilltop in Tibet, they have the recipe. And that just can't happen with wine, mainly because the laws countries have. You know, like just pulling something out of my hat, I don't know what country this would apply to, but like in order to call your wine Merlot, it has to have 85% Merlot grapes in there. There's no mystery. We know what it is. Right. We know what your product is.
Yeah, exactly. And like I'm like, you know what? I'll drink Merlot all day, but it's like, yeah, I would be more intrigued by that glass of Chartreuse VEP and just knowing that I'm drinking like a glass of strange history, you know?
Yeah, and that's why whenever I come across a wine writer who writes with real engagement, who really gets me intrigued, I know that's a talented person.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's definitely true. You know, and then like. Even with those, with the history of the spirit, then you've got the history of the mixture of those spirits together, and you know, I love it when I meet people from Italy or France, and like we talk about like vermouth or any kind of liqueur, and like the way that we mix them together because we can't leave anything alone as Americans, you know.
No,
especially when I met the Count, Count Braga, like. It's like, what the hell is everyone doing with our product? It's like, you're mixing it with what? You're doing what with it? I'm just so intrigued by it. And it was something that was never, you know, because the mixture itself was the maceration, the infusion, and then the distillate, and then the aging. That was the whole process. And to us, we took something that was already mixed and created and really finessed, and then we started finessing it even more with other ingredients. So it's kind of
that's always the American genius: take something that's already out there and then do something further that's great with it. We didn't create the initial thing, but then we improve it somehow, and that's what we did with cocktails.
Exactly, we made it faster, and we painted flames on it,
and made it individual. It's all for you. It's not a bowl of punch. It's your cocktail. Absolutely. That's only for you.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That being said, yeah, going back to that, I share the same sentiment. What got me interested in cocktails was exactly the same thing as you. Like, there's the story, the history.
And I love history, and I love ritual. That's another reason why I like it so much. There are rituals that are connected to wine, to any kind of drinking, to beer, whatever. But there are so many piled on top of each other. You know, I mean, you just take a drink like the old-fashioned. I mean, and if you make the old-fashioned in the old-fashioned way, you get the sugar cube, and then you have to soak it with the Angostura bitters, and then you have to muddle it. I mean, you could do simple syrup, and many people do, and that's just fine. But the ritual of muddling the cube is so historic and goes along with that drink going back 100, 130 years. And that kind of thing is great. You know, the same with drinks like the Sazerac or for... You know, the theatrical people out there, things like the Blue Blazer for people who do that.
I love making Blue Blazers so much.
Yeah, Blue Blazers, for those who don't know, throwing the liquor back and forth between, are they silver or pewter tankards?
They originally were silver. I use brass, silver-lined brass mugs.
And the liquor's on fire. That's and important to state.
Yeah. you forgot that part.
Yes.
I think, to me, especially with the ritual... and we definitely don't have to get into this, but I think you mentioned muddling the sugar cube. I think that there's also a certain, especially like the culinary side of it, like having the proper tools to make the drinks and the proper like dishes, the proper glassware. I think that's another big thing too. Like that, but that all falls into the ritual, I suppose.
Yes, it does. I mean, the glassware has changed over the years. I was talking to someone about this, about glassware. In the early part of the 19th century, apparently the glassware wasn't that much different from other glass. You know, put it in a kind of a wine glass. But
the ritual was such
that certain drinks developed their own glass. The Old Fashioned has its own glass. The Collins has its own glass. The Martini has its own glass. And, you know, there's no real good reason. I mean, there is to a certain extent. But, you know, you could serve it in other glasses, but that's not how it was done. This is how it's done. You put the old-fashioned in the old-fashioned glass. You know, and I love that kind of stuff. It's just beautiful.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a quick break, Robert. And when we get back, we'll continue speaking about just our favorite subject, about the history of cocktails and writing about them and bringing them to the world. Back in just a moment.
You're listening to Dirty Hands by Eula on the Speakeasy. And this is HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
And we are back. You're listening to the Speakeasy. Jack, who was that?
That's a band called Eula. Yeah.
They were pretty rad.
Pretty good.
Okay, we've been speaking with Robert Simonson.
Hey, Damon, who's the band that plays the theme song to your show?
That's my band, Brothers.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. A little nepotism there.
Oh, nice, strange, awkward plug. I wasn't ready for that, Jack. Do you have the gotcha tiger thing going? We've been speaking with Robert Simonson, definitely one of my favorite, cocktail and spirits writers. Not just because you've written me up a bunch of times, but I always enjoy our conversations and, really respect your opinions on cocktails and spirits. And on that note, I really, from one person who interviews people about drinks to another one, I would like to know your process and like what you find, like how you find stories and what you find interesting and how you develop these into the articles that you write.
Finding the stories is just basically talking to a lot of people like you, talking to bartenders, mixologists, bar owners. Just like any reporter's job, you have to be out there in the field, yeah, with your feet on the ground, which basically means going to a lot of bars. I mean, that's how
the best research policy ever.
There's no way that you can do this job if you're at home reading books or talking to people on the phone or I don't know how you would do it. You have to go out and you have to drink and get into great conversations with bartenders or fellow drinkers or, perusing menus, seeing what's going on. And it doesn't take long, you know. I mean, I don't think a week or two goes by that I don't notice incrementally something that's going on in the bar world.
As far as like a drinks trend?
Yeah. And I hate to use that word because
I
know that that's how a lot of people think about what I do and what other journalists do, that we just find two or three things in common and then we call it a trend, and maybe it's not a trend, you know, and as we put a label on it. Unfortunately, that's how a lot of journalism works, and editors do look for trend stories.
Sure.
And I try to make sure that these are actual things before I write about them. And if that means I'm a little late to the story, if other people have already written it and said, trend, you know, I'll hang back a little longer saying, well, let's see if it actually is a trend, just because there's one place in Williamsburg that's doing it and one place in East Village. Let's not say that's a story, you know, let's just wait a little while.
Right. I mean, like, as far as, I mean, this era that we're in with cocktails, it's very quickly moving in so many directions, and we have more access to any like all these ingredients that than we've ever had before. And when you start looking at cocktail trends, if you want to call it that, historically, I mean, you look at the 1870s to the 1880s, and a lot of stuff changed, but that was two different decades. You know, like the introduction of absinthe into cocktails, the switch over from like rye or from cognac to rye because of phylloxera, you know, and like then you start looking at, you know, the 30s, 40s with like tiki drinks, you know, starting to be introduced, you know, like you can't really like put a decade on it now.
It's every 6 months. Everything turns over, and it's something that I worry about a little bit because once something starts happening, it happens very quickly because everyone in this industry is talking to each other. They're on the phone, they're on email, they're on Facebook, on Twitter. So if somebody in Portland is doing something interesting, someone in Brooklyn finds out about it the next day and maybe starts doing it the day after
that. Or even that night.
And then some reporter like me comes around and writes about it. And I worry about burning out good trends before they deserve to die. Because, you know, the trend will, at this point, trends like, whatever, barrel aging, for example, it'll burn white hot for a year. And then suddenly you'll start getting the articles, oh, that's over. And if it's a good idea, it shouldn't be over. I mean, just because it's not trendy anymore, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have a barrel-aged cocktail on your menu. It's still a good idea. Some trend ideas deserve to die. They weren't good ideas, so let them go. But other ones, like, you know, if you're using... I mean, I've talked to you about using vinegar as an acid in cocktails, you know, and that's a good idea that should stay. Yeah. You know, and it's just like, but... things come and go, and I worry about how fast things go these days.
Yeah. I remember, well, the article about vinegar cocktails, after that was published in the New York Times, I got boxes and boxes of vinegar from all kinds of importers, producers, distributors.
Was any of it any good?
Yeah, there's definitely some good stuff. But
you're welcome then.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Fred. Yeah. And I should share some with you because I probably have like 200 bottles of vinegar that got sent to me because of that article. So thank you.
Well, pass the savings on to the consumer.
Yeah. What made me, like, exactly what you were saying is like vinegar in cocktails, it's not the newest idea. I mean, people were making shrubs, you know, 200 years ago.
Well, that's another thing. Almost every idea that we're coming up with now was created like a century ago or even later. You know, I mean, when people ooh and ah over the flaming of an orange rind over a drink, which we've all done, and Dale DeGroff, the famous mixologist, has taught us to do, I've read accounts of that happening in 1913. So, I mean, it's we're just reviving all these great ideas that were lost.
And, you know, like you were saying, it does piss me off a little bit when people, like, just, like, steamroll over a trend. Like, or a quote-unquote trend, as it were. There are certain techniques, like you said, and certain ingredients
that
should not be trendy. I mean, like, we're just bringing stuff back that was lost for a while, and... You have to respect that, you know.
And it took us this long to get it back.
And barely,
you know, I mean,
yeah.
Let's keep it, you know. Let's not just say, oh, well, that was fun. Now we're going to forget about it again.
That was fun.
I mean, right now we're all very hot on sherry cocktails, and that's fantastic. Sherry's a wonderful ingredient in cocktails.
Absolutely.
Everyone's enjoying it. There's been a lot of articles about it. I hope it continues. I hope people continue to be interested and not just get bored.
Do you think it is just a product of, like... Like the modern reader, consumer,
absolutely.
Do you think it's journalism in itself. Do you think it's a little bit of both? I mean, is it like
both
style trends? Everything, like
both readers and journalism. Yeah, you know, the attention span is just too short.
Yeah,
and the news cycle is too fast. But perhaps I'm worrying too much. It seems to me that you guys, bartenders, mixologists, you kind of stick by your guns if you like something, and you're going to keep doing it. I doubt that Jeffrey Morgenthaler, the bartender out in Portland, who's mainly responsible for bringing us barrel-aged cocktails, is going to give up on them. he's just going to keep doing it.
Oh, I'm sure he doesn't give a fuck about what anyone writes about. Like, if it's not trendy anymore, or, like, not a cool thing to do anymore, it's like, you know what? Barrel-aging a cocktail is, in my opinion, always going to be really cool. As long as it's done right and it tastes well,
yeah,
that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of talk about a lot of mixologists that take too long to make drinks. And you know what? It's kind of, in my opinion, one of the biggest, like, fuck yous to that kind of statement. It's like, you know what? It took me seven weeks
to make this cocktail.
It took me 7 weeks.
Exactly. And it was worth it.
And it was totally worth it, you know? I find, though, like, you know, with as far as, like, trends go, one of the biggest things, and I talk about it a lot on the show and just around, but to me, one of the biggest trends that's happening right now is bartenders and bars getting more into customer service.
Mm-hmm.
It was for a very long time, several years now, it was more about what was in the glass rather than what was in the room,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I find that to be really, really refreshing.
Yes.
And
yeah, no, I think we've turned that corner. I think the haughty, snobbish bartender is perhaps a thing of the past. I mean, it depends where you are in the nation, because, like, if you're in, like, a smaller city in the heartland that's just getting into the cocktail renaissance, they kind of have to go through those phases again, you know, only a few years later than New York or San Francisco or LA has done it. But yeah, people have remembered service. I don't really blame the bartenders and the mixologists for acting the way they did at the beginning, because they had discovered something very cool. They had rediscovered the art of bartending, and that it was actually a respectable profession. It was a profession of artistry, and they were proud, and they took it seriously. And if someone comes into the bar and doesn't take that seriously, well, it might get your back up a little bit, and you might forget customer absolutely. Service a little bit. But so I give them that time period. I understand perhaps why it happened, but I'm glad now that we've remembered the customer. I mean, the customer has caught up a bit now.
Absolutely.
They understand. They understand, and they're into it too, and they want to have the conversation. And even if they don't want to have the conversation, there's sort of a recognition that that guy behind the bar, he knows what he's doing, and he's doing something as special as the guy in the kitchen. Now, can I have my drink?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's really, I mean, you mentioned the bartenders taking their time to, like, get through the hump with the customers, and you know, it's an educational job,
mm-hmm.
being a mixologist bartender. It's something that you work a lot on your craft. You study a lot through history, mm-hmm. and through recipes and techniques, but it takes people like yourself to enlighten, you know, the rest of the country, the rest of the world, through your national publications, to educate the consumer of what this is and how it's done. And just in the same way that, like, what makes a good bartender also can make a good customer, you know, and to bring that together, and also to enlighten and educate people, that's your job, and you've been doing a really great job of it, and I really appreciate it. I just want to say that.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. It's an enjoyable job. What do I have to do?
I
got to tell you.
Look at what we're doing today. We're just sitting in the studio. It's a sunny day in Brooklyn, and we're having a beer, and just talking about the things we love.
Exactly.
Robert, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
It's been a while. I've been trying to get you on for a while, but I'm so glad we got to have this conversation today, and I can't wait to have you on again.
I'm glad it finally happened. Love to be on again.
All right. That's it for the Speakeasy this week. It's been Damon Bolte and Robert Simonson. Until next week, cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.